Live from the Regis Suite in Phoenix, Arizona. This is Understanding Autism. Hi, everyone. Welcome to the show. I'm Dave Isaac, alongside Kimberly Isaac and Paul Loudon. And we're here together, as opposed to yesterday. We were all flooded out, but now we're in one room. Much better
much
to do
better.
It that way.
Yes.
So, Kim and Paul, let's start with Kim. A little bit of background about yourself, and then we'll move it over to Paul.
Yes, my name is Kim Isaac Emery. I'm a co-host of Understanding Autism Radio Show. I'm an autism specialist and a certified RDI program consultant. I specialize in working with teens and adults on the spectrum, as well as parent training and education.
Nice.
I'm Paul Loudon. I am an adult on the autism spectrum. I'm 31 years old, and I was diagnosed at the age of 23, and I take my time sharing my experiences, what I've learned about autism since I received my diagnosis.
And I'll tell you, this is such a unique radio show where you sort of have the outside and the inside perspective. That's a nice way to put it, and very valuable. It gives inspiration, hope, motivation, and, of course, we have a very special guest that does the same thing. Kim, do the honors.
Yes, we have a very special guest with us, one of our favorite guests, Dr. Jim Adams. He is the director of Arizona State University's Autism and Asperger's Research Program. He's also the president of the Autism Society of Greater Phoenix and the president of the Autism Nutrition Research Center. He's published over 30 scientific research studies on autism, including several studies on gut problems and gut bacteria in children with autism. And he was actually on yesterday, and we spoke about the gut problems and the upcoming study. And so we're just excited to welcome back to the show today Dr. Jim Adams. Dr. Adams, are you with us?
Yes, I am. Hi, Kim. Hi, Paul. Hi, Dave.
Welcome back.
Hey, how are you?
Thank you.
So today we're going to be talking about another topic, very important topic, seizures and autism. And so, Dr. Adams, maybe you can give listeners a little bit of a background on seizures and autism.
Sure. Seizures are one of several medical co-occurring conditions that are very common in autism. So in the general population, about 1% of the general population has epilepsy or seizures, whereas for individuals on the autism spectrum, that number, instead of 1%, is about 25 to 35% of individuals with autism eventually develop seizures. So it may be a smaller percentage when they're younger, but then as they get older, as they go through adolescence and then hit adulthood, it's more and more common for seizures to occur in those older individuals.
Dr. Adams, I was just going to ask you a question. That's interesting because, you know, I think people with epilepsy, when they're younger, often they grow out of it. So it sounds like you're saying that it's almost the opposite with those on the spectrum. Do you have any idea how that works?
Well, you're exactly right. It's absolutely the opposite that. You may not have, the most common case is not to have seizures when you're younger, but then to develop them as you get older. There are many mysteries about seizures. In most cases, we don't know the cause of seizures. In most cases, it often can be hard to treat them. But it goes beyond there, too. One really important message I think that most people aren't aware of is that in addition to 35% of adults developing seizures, actually about 60 to 80% of people on the spectrum have what we call subclinical seizures or abnormal EEG activity. So almost everyone on the spectrum, if you do a 24-hour EEG, they're going to show signs of very abnormal electrical activity, not quite enough to cause a full-blown seizure, but enough to disrupt their normal thought processes, to affect their ability to learn and remember, pay attention, and may affect behavior as well. So that's something that not very many people are aware of because it's not something physically obvious, but it's very much affecting their mental functioning, we think.
And I've actually seen, working with families, kids and adults on the spectrum, I've seen individuals have different degrees of seizures where, I've seen what maybe people would classify in their mind as what they would define as a seizure, the grand mal seizure, where it's very observable, the shaking and, you know, all of that. But I've also seen individuals who kind of just like either stare off what seems like staring off in space or just get really, really quiet or, you know, and I guess, Dr. Adams, I'm wondering, is would it be helpful for maybe for the listeners to better understand maybe the different types of seizures? And I think it can be hard, I guess, for parents to identify what they might be considering as some, you know, their child just, you know, staring off into space, not paying attention, whatever, if there's certain things that they can look for that might indicate that it's a type of seizure.
Yeah, that's a great point. The classic type of seizure people are familiar with is what's called either a grand mal seizure or a generalized seizure. So the whole body is seizing or twitching or sometimes just becomes extremely rigid, and the person usually loses consciousness during that. But you can also have a partial seizure where just part of the person's body is seizing, moving uncontrollably, or, again, becoming very rigid, and the person may be conscious during that. And those are still usually fairly easy to observe. But the third type, Kim, that you mentioned, the absent seizure, can be much harder to notice, where a child is just staring off into space and just not moving, just not responding to anything. And sometimes that may just be mistaken for ADHD, or they're just not paying attention. But the real question, the real way to differentiate it, is can you get a response out of them? If you touch them, if you shake them, if you talk to them, can they respond? And if they can't, then I'd be concerned and want to take them to a physician or even a neurologist. Again, I should preface this by saying I'm not a medical physician, but we've published a major study on looking at seizures in kids with autism, and especially looking at treatments for seizures. And so I've gained some experience by the neurologist I've been lucky enough to work with.
Yes, I think that's very helpful how you described it, because I do think, I mean, especially, you know, people on the spectrum, they just, everybody's so different. While there are definitely some commonalities, you know, sometimes it can be hard when parents are facing other challenges. You know, their kids might be having, you know, like we spoke about yesterday, gut problems, and they're uncomfortable, and they're crying and tantruming. And, you know, it can be really hard for parents to notice certain things. And a lot of times, I mean, I'm surprised at the numbers. I knew it was high in autism, but I didn't realize when you mentioned the 60 to 80% subclinical, I was really surprised by that. But that tells me that maybe, you know, I mean, it sounds like maybe people should consider that more, you know, if they're noticing certain things in their kids, you know, is to go get, to go see a neurologist and just check all that out before assuming it's something else, like you said, ADHD or, you know, not paying attention intentionally or whatever. So I think that's right. Really helpful for parents to understand that.
Yeah, because the percentages are so high, I think every child should be every parent should discuss the possibility of seizures with their physician, and I think that in many cases they should be tested. The problem is that often the testing it will be just a two-hour EEG, and that can miss a lot of information. Also, it's more common for seizures to occur during the nighttime, so it's very easy for parents not to be aware that their child has had a seizure during the night unless they're watching them. And so that's why it's so important to do an overnight EEG, because often the seizures are more common in the nighttime. And you might think, oh, they had a seizure, big deal. But when a child has a seizure, it may take a day or two for them to recover from the effects of that seizure. Their thinking can be very disrupted and very hard for them to concentrate afterwards.
Dr. Adams, are there anything specifically that would trigger a seizure externally?
It's a great question. It does seem that certain things can trigger seizures. So for some individuals, it can be just stress, if they become more stressed. Also, it seems that seizures the tendency for a seizure seems to build up over time. So often you may go for a little period without a seizure, and then you'll have one, and then you'll be somewhat protected for a little while until another one will come later. So sometimes there's this cyclic effect. Sometimes exercise can help reduce the risk of a seizure. That seems to help protect in some cases. Again, a calm environment. As one individual I know who had seizures throughout her childhood and adulthood until she gave up artificial colors, artificial flavors. And then she became seizure-free just by doing that. But then one day she happened to have a green drink that had artificial colors, and then she had a seizure that day. But since then, for many years, it's been seizure-free. So it's rare when we can find a cause like that, but often it's estimated in probably 80% of cases we don't know the cause of seizures and what's going on. We have some hypotheses, and we can talk about that, but we really don't know the cause in most cases.
I have a question. So a lot of seizures are potentially being undetected, but what happens if someone's having seizures, detected or undetected? If not treated, do they get worse over time? Do they cause other neurological problems?
It's pretty clear that the seizure event itself is disrupting memory and learning. Most people will talk about having an effect after the seizure. It takes them a day or two for them to recover and get back to normal. So that may, depending on the frequency of that seizure, if you're having a seizure once a week, you can be losing a lot of critical learning time. One of the things I'm very concerned about, and that really got my attention, is that unfortunately seizures are the leading cause of death for individuals with autism up until their 20s or 30s. That seizures are life-threatening, not the seizure itself, but the falling down that might occur with that seizure. So some individuals who are seizure-prone will wear a helmet just because of the high likelihood that they'll fall and hurt themselves. Or if a higher-functioning individual, if they were driving a car and had a seizure, they could have an accident. So generally, people who have epilepsy are very limited in their ability to drive or may not be able to. So it's a very serious issue, and I've had to sadly go to a funeral of a child who died from a seizure, a young boy, and that really made me want to do more to look at trying to understand the causes of seizures and especially how to treat them. And that's why we did a national study of 1,000 families to try to find out what treatments they were using and to get a sense from them of what treatments seemed to be effective or not effective.
You know, it's interesting. I actually was hit by a car about maybe 15 years ago. A person did have a seizure while driving. It was very, very scary. At first thought was, oh my gosh, this person must be drunk. They literally crossed into, like, over the median into the opposite, you know, direction of traffic. It was really scary. And once I realized it, the car kept going and actually went through a backyard and into somebody's home. You know, later on we found out that person had epilepsy. And I guess, I don't know if that person had autism or not, but I guess I'm wondering too, as far as, you know, treatments, medications, how effective are medications? Do they fully prevent seizures? Or, I mean, what are your thoughts on that?
That's a great question. From a number of physicians I've spoken with, the general sense I have is that about a third of the time, a single medication will be helpful in reducing or stopping seizures. Another third of the time, it may take two or three medications. And in about a third of the time, unfortunately, the seizures are untreatable through standard medications, and then other more extreme treatments are considered. And so that's the general impression that people have for looking at the seizures. The use of these medications. But I have a lot of concerns about those medications because I was very surprised by the results of our large study. When we surveyed 1,000 families, we found that, yes, these anti-seizure medications are helpful in stopping seizures, and we evaluated 13, and we found 4 that seemed to be especially helpful at stopping seizures. But we also asked, what are the effects on other symptoms? And that was where the real surprise came in. That it was very sad to see that when you look at other symptoms, and so we looked at many other symptoms, And what we found is that all of these seizure medications tended to worsen all of the other five symptoms we looked at. So they tended to worsen sleep, they tended to worsen communication, they worsened behavior, they worsened attention, and they worsened mood. So you were paying a high price. These anti-seizure medications should not be used lightly, I think. And, yes, they can help prevent seizures, which can be life-threatening, but they seem to worsen all other aspects of life. And so by looking at the 13 medications in our survey, we were able to identify four that had the least adverse effects. Still, they tended to worsen symptoms, but just not as much as the others. And again, this is an on average. So I think it's important to look at the four medications that we found were most effective and consider those first, but then realize that each person's an individual, so one medication may have less side effects than another.
Well, Dr. Adams, we're going to take a quick break right now. When we come back, we'll continue our discussion. We're talking about seizures and the autism spectrum. This is Understanding Autism, and we'll be right back.
It's now time for the word association game. Contestants, go ahead.
Bars. Meat market. Gas.
High prices.
Politicians.
Liars.
Auto mechanics.
Ripoff. Guys, whoa, wait a minute here. Not when I think of my auto mechanic, I think of trust, care, safety, and fairness. This sounds like the definition of a friend, which was what Alexander's All Care Automotive Repair achieves with his customers. The peace of mind that comes with a mechanic that puts you first. Located at 3310 East Thomas Road, Phoenix, 85018. Call 602-956-3781. 602-956-3781.
At Beerenbaum Baum and Speen PC, we want to help you work on your business, not in your business. We take a simple approach. You know your business. Our firm gives you the information to make those decisions better. Our firm takes a proactive approach to your accounting needs, and if you look behind the numbers, you'll find there are hidden opportunities that we try to impart on you. Communication is the key to that understanding, and there is no charge for brief phone calls. Contact us at 602-266-5633. Or email us at mitch@jfbpc.com. Beerenbaum and Speen works to increase your understanding of your business in order to make the decisions necessary to move your business forward.
Ridenour, Heinzen & Lewis is a multi-practice law firm, ideally equipped to assist with a broad range of legal and business issues, corporate and financial transactions, real estate, commercial, litigation, bankruptcy, and private client practice. Ridenour, Heinten & Lewis is a law firm that bases its practice on understanding the businesses of their clients, and they use this insight to meet each client's unique and evolving legal challenges. Call or click today, 602-254-9900. Find them on the web at rhkl-law.com.
And welcome back again. You're listening to Understanding Autism every second Monday and Tuesday of the month from 3 to 4. I'm Dave Isaac alongside Paul Loudon and Kimberly Isaac, our very special guest today, as well as yesterday, Dr. Jim Adams. Kim, you had a really, really interesting question on the break, I think, that you may want to ask.
I have two questions, actually. My first question is, Dr. Adams, could you describe what a seizure is exactly? Like, what is happening in the brain?
Okay. Yeah, that's a great way to start. So a seizure is just uncontrolled electrical activity. So what happens is we have neurons in our brain that communicate with one another. So one neuron will send a chemical message to another neuron, and there'll be an electrical signal that will accompany that. And what happens in a normal person is we regulate that so that one neuron doesn't fire too easily or with too much difficulty. So that way when we send a signal from one neuron to another, it gets passed along as a normal thought process. But when a seizure occurs, then it's too easy for a neuron to fire. And so it fires too many times and just keeps firing. So there's a loss of control. And so during a seizure, then, that can cause that repetitive movement, or it can become so severe that the motion is actually, the signals are actually locked and the limb becomes paralyzed. There's just too much electrical activity there for it to even move at all.
Wow. Okay, that was very clear. Thank you for explaining that, because seizures happen on the inside of the brain. And, I mean, sometimes we see a physical manifestation. I think it helps people to better understand that. So that was really helpful. My second question is, do individuals on the spectrum who are having seizures, do they actually end up receiving a dual diagnosis of epilepsy with autism?
Yes, epilepsy just means that you've had two or more seizures. So it's not uncommon for some people to have one seizure at some point in their life. My daughter was on the bus with a friend. That friend had one seizure one time in his life, took him to a hospital, got him taken care of. But if you have two or more seizures, then we call that epilepsy. And so, yes, individuals with autism can have epilepsy the same way they can also have cognitive dysfunction or GI problems or other things. The thing to be aware of is that kids with autism are just more than 30 times as likely as the general population to develop epilepsy.
So maybe you could tell us a little bit, I mean, you started to, about some of the research, but what can you tell us about the current state of research on seizures and autism?
Yeah. In general, there's a huge amount we don't know, so I'll do some speculation too. Right now, we know that about 80% of seizures, we just can't identify the cause of for a particular individual. There are probably multiple different causes. We do know that seizures seem to be more common in the kids who are more severe. So those kids who have more severe autism, more severe intellectual impairment, are somewhat more likely to have seizures. Seizures seem to be about as likely in boys and as girls. But as they get older, as either group gets older, and especially when they go through puberty and then when they hit adulthood, that's when the seizures become very common. And people may have not one type of seizure, they may have more than one type. They might have a generalized seizure one day, they might have a partial seizure, an absent seizure the other day. So again, it varies for an individual. Also, one of the things that we found out that was a bit of a surprise from our study is we noticed that some individuals with autism, of course, have autism from early infancy. Some develop it after regression. And so what we did was, one of the questions we asked was just, when your child regressed, was there anything that seemed to be associated with that? And about 40% of the time, they said the regression seemed to be associated with the seizure. That, in other words, after that seizure, that's when the downhill fall into autism began for those kids with regressive autism. About 25% of the time, it seemed to be due to a high fever or a viral illness. But the real shocker is that according to families, and again, this is just what families report, they said that in 70% of the cases, they said that regression seemed to be after a vaccination and seem to be associated with that. So it just makes us suspicious of that link. And again, that's a parent-reported link, and one could spend a whole session on vaccinations and autism, but we won't get into that.
Okay.
Otherwise, we could spend the whole day on that, and that's very controversial. But coming back to what's not controversial is we do know that seizures, you asked me earlier what a seizure is. It's an uncontrolled electrical activity. So we think what's going on in autism is that there's an imbalance between two types of neurotransmitters, that you have one neurotransmitter in your body called glutamate, and that is a highly excitatory neurotransmitter. That's the main excitatory neurotransmitter that makes the neurons fire. There's another neurotransmitter called GABA, and that's the one that keeps them from firing. So what you want is a balance. You want some glutamate and some GABA so that you have some firing, but not too much firing. And so that balance is very important. And we think that in kids with autism, there's some unpublished data we've seen that kids with autism have way too much glutamate. So it's way too easy for their neurons to fire. And they don't seem to have enough GABA, that they don't have enough to stop the neurons once they do fire. So we think that the seizures are just the extreme case, but we think that a lot of issues in autism, like being hypersensitive to sounds or foods, or having difficulty concentrating, ADD, we think that's probably just too much of this excitatory neurotransmitter. And so one of the things we'd like to learn is how can we better balance those neurotransmitters? How can we have less glutamate and more GABA? And it turns out that an easy thing to do, which has only limited effect, but has a little effect, is to give vitamin B6, because vitamin B6 converts glutamate to GABA. So by giving B6, you get less of the excitatory and more of the inhibitory neurotransmitters.
Well, actually, I'm glad you brought that up. That's kind of related to a question that occurred to me while you were talking. Are there certain foods that people eat that contribute to the production of glutamate or GABA, and is there a way through diet to help balance that out?
Yeah, glutamate is present in many foods. So MSG is monosodium glutamate. And so although there's a lot of controversy about does MSG cause migraines and other mental challenges, it does seem that some individuals are sensitive to monosodium glutamate. One of my friends was developing Parkinson-like symptoms, and they noticed that seemed to be associated with when they ate MSG, and which is especially common in Chinese restaurants, but also other places. And so that's just one of many sources. But it is actually present in a lot of food, and you need some of it. The issue is you just don't want too much of it. But it's interesting you bring up diet, because when we surveyed our families, these 1,000 families, about what treatments helped them the most, it's very interesting. We looked at not just the seizure medications that I spoke about, which helped in improving, in reducing seizures, but they also worsened all your other symptoms. According to the families, we looked at 20 other alternative treatments, vitamins and minerals and other things, and they've reported that there were 3 diets that really made a difference in reducing seizures and actually not worsening symptoms, but they actually improved all of those 5 symptoms that I mentioned. And so there's a lot of interest in these special diets for individuals with seizures, and we're very interested in looking at those diets for kids with autism and seizures.
Are they particular diets that you can refer to by name?
Yeah, there are 3 special diets that families reported. The most common one that's been used for many, many years for seizures is called the ketogenic diet. And that's a very extreme diet where your diet is about 80% fat, 20% protein, and 0 carbs. So a typical meal would be a stick of butter, some very fatty bacon, and some sour cream. That would be a typical diet for your meal.
Wow.
I mean, hard to imagine eating that. But the results of that diet are amazing, that for about half of individuals with epilepsy, it greatly reduces or stops their seizures. The problem is it's really hard to continue on that diet. So that's why we're very interested in another type of diet called a modified Atkins diet. And that has, it's somewhat similar. It's high fat, high protein, but more protein, and again, near zero carbs. So it just means eating lean meats. It means eating meats, but also fat, but some vegetables in there as well. And that diet is a lot better tolerated. So it's like the Atkins diet, a little bit modified. And that diet seems to be very well tolerated and seems to help about half of individuals with epilepsy.
Wow, that's so interesting. Why don't we actually take a short break? I have a question for when we come back. We'll just take a short break and we'll continue our discussion about seizures and autism with our special guest, Dr. Jim Adams. We'll be right back.
Money to the IRS? Have you heard of possible payment options such as a partial payment installment agreement, offering compromise, or not currently collectible status? Knowing that you have options and what those options are will greatly relieve your worry and stress. Hi, my name is Dave Isaac, CPA and former government tax auditor. If you are curious as to what options may be available to you if you owe money to the IRS, my 25 years experience as a CPA may very well help you in these times of uncertainty. Stop worrying and start learning about what options you have. If you just want to talk to someone about your IRS debt or want specific advice, I invite you to call me at 602-625-3074. That is 602-625-3074. And when you call, ask for me, Dave Isaac, CPA and former government tax auditor.
Buying or selling a home is one of the biggest events in your life. Wouldn't it be nice to have the guidance of a professional realtor that you can trust? I'm Tara Alves with HomeSmart, and I have been working with buyers and sellers in the Valley for well over a decade. As a native, I know the local market and I'm dedicated to meeting the needs of each and every client. I don't want to just list your home, I want to sell it and help you find a new place to call home. Call me for a free property valuation or for any real estate needs. Integrity, knowledge, professionalism, and results. That's what being a realtor means to me. Call today at 602-430-3397. That's 602-430-3397. Thank you.
It's always great to have a friend in business. That's why we encourage you to reach out to Brandon Ross at Burt Carpenter Financial, a full-service residential lender. Call now for exceptional service and an accurate pre-qualification. Connect with him online at BrandonRossHomeLoans.com or by phone at 602-953-7826, 602-953-7826. Brandon Ross, NMLS number 858655, and Burt Carpenter Financial, NMLS number 142159.
Weidenauer, Heinten & Lewis is a multi-practice law firm, ideally equipped to assist with a broad range of legal and business issues, corporate and financial transactions, real estate, commercial, litigation, bankruptcy, and private client practice. Weidenauer, Heinten & Lewis is a law firm that bases its practice on understanding the businesses of their clients, and they use this insight to meet each client's unique and evolving legal challenges. Call or click today, 602-254-9900. Find them on the web at rhkl-law.com.
Hey And welcome back again. You're listening to Understanding Autism, heard every second Monday and Tuesday of the month from 3 to 4 Phoenix time. Right now that is Pacific Standard Time, but I think about a month and we're going to...
We'll be considered mountain. Yeah, we never change time, but yes.
And you know why? Because we just don't know how. You know what they say about Phoenicians. Anyway, we're so honored to have Dr. Jim Adams as our special guest once again and talking about seizures. And, Kim, I know you have another couple questions, and I have a question because this is a very helpful topic. And Dr. Adams, again, thank you for explaining so nicely to our listeners.
So my question is, I'm wondering, and this might be speculating, but if this ketogenic, I'm not sure if I'm saying it right, diet is helping. Okay, thank you. I'm just curious, with the zero carbs, if does sugar impact glutamate and GABA? Like, what about the zero carbs, or does fat transport things differently? You know, is there anything in your mind that leads some sort of clue, like some sort of trail to why that might be so helpful?
It's a great question, and the honest answer is we don't really know why these two diets work, but we do know they help about half of individuals with epilepsy, and by helping, I mean it usually reduces seizure frequency by 50%, sometimes 90%, sometimes even 100%. But the ketogenic diet is really hard to do because it's such a high-fat diet, and that's why the modified Atkins diet seems better. But in terms of why it works, both diets share in common, they have virtually zero carbs, almost total elimination of carbs. And so what do carbs do? Do our bodies really need carbs? And the answer is no. For human nutrition, our bodies have to have protein to make our muscles and many other parts of our body. We have to have fat because we need that for many other parts of our body. And we have to have vitamins and minerals. But humans don't have to have carbs. So our hypothesis, and this is just a hypothesis, is that we think an issue with the carbs is that they're feeding bad bacteria in our guts, and those bacteria in turn go on to create neurotransmitters. So in our gut study, we looked at 50 different metabolites that gut bacteria make. We found that 7 of them were different in kids with autism, and those 7 related to, guess what, glutamate and several other neurotransmitters. And so I think what's happening is that by going on a carb-free diet, you're then starving the bad gut bacteria, so then they can't make the glutamate. They don't have the energy to make the glutamate and cause these seizures. That's speculation. I think it's pretty reasonable speculation.
That is so interesting. I'm still in shock by the fact that our bodies don't need carbs. I feel like I've seen so many things, you know, recommended daily, you know, different things like starches and fruits and vegetables. So if we don't need carbs, I mean, I don't know. Why do you think that it's recommended as part of our diet?
Yeah, carbs are just a fuel source. So you can get calories from fat, you can get it from protein. And so people on these extreme diets, the ketogenic diet or the modified Atkins diet, can live well, can live normally. You have to be cautious that you get enough vitamins and minerals that way. So that's why I think the modified Atkins diet is better. It has more intake of vitamins and minerals. But you don't need carbs. They are a fuel source. But instead, you can get your fuel from protein and fat just as well.
That's amazing. That is just fascinating. I have a question, just going back a little bit. You talked about neurotransmitters where it fires and it sort of goes out of control, the electrical nature of that. What if the opposite occurs, where it doesn't fire at all? Is that an opposite of a seizure, or is that a problem at all?
Yeah, that would be a very extreme case where someone would then be essentially catatonic. They wouldn't respond to any stimuli. And so we respond to stimuli every day. You know, it could be the stimulus of your alarm going off to wake you to get out of bed. Could be the signals from your stomach telling you that you're hungry and go eat. And so I'm not aware of any conditions where people have that extreme case, but basically that's what would happen is if you had too lower level, then you would be under-responsive to many things. You'd probably be sluggish too, I think. But again, that's a little bit out of my area. I'm so focused on the opposite issue, which is what happens in autism and epilepsy. I was just going to say, one of the interesting connections, too, and this digresses a little bit, but we know that kids with autism, we know that exposure to pesticides is one of several risk factors for autism. And the way a lot of pesticides work is they actually cause seizures in insects. So they attack a certain part. Most pesticides work by affecting a certain neurotransmitter in the insect and then inducing a seizure, actually so many seizures that the insect becomes paralyzed and dies. And unfortunately, that exact same neurotransmitter is present in humans. And that's why, again, I'm very leery of pesticides, and the research is clear that exposure to pesticides is a risk factor for autism and probably a risk factor for seizures as well.
Wow, so that's why there's so much controversy and so much support, I guess,
we're quiet because we're just kind of in shock here that, wow, I had no idea that's how pesticides, they obviously got rid of the bugs, but I had no idea it affected their central nervous system.
Right, it's just the bugs get it at a much higher concentration, whereas in humans it will still have some effect. So when you spray pesticides in your home, and you might spray it once every 3 months or once a year, depending on the pesticide you're using, the reason you can use it so infrequently is because it's toxic for such a long period of time. Now, not everyone is sensitive to it, but kids with autism seem to have an impaired ability to detoxify pesticides and other chemicals, so they build up to higher levels in their bodies and cause more problems. That's what we think. Again, I'm speculating a little bit, but that's a very reasonable speculation.
So how do people, so we all have exposure to pesticides to some degree. How does our body get rid of them?
There are certain enzymes in our body that help break down various chemicals and pesticides. It's a two-stage detoxification process. And we know that kids with autism have impairments. So, for example, there are 4 studies showing that kids with autism have a very decreased ability to detoxify Tylenol. And that's a very standard way to check for one detoxification pathway. There are actually quite a few major detoxification pathways. And for autism, that's the one that's been most investigated. But there are many other different pathways depending on which chemical it is.
So if somebody has an impaired ability to detoxify, what can you do to help individuals to detoxify?
Well, I think there are 2 things. First of all, decreasing their exposure, so what limited capacity they have isn't used as much. And then secondly, just providing nutritional support to try to improve that. So coming back to seizures then, if someone has seizures, I think it would be wise to try to limit or reduce or eliminate their exposure to toxic chemicals, including pesticides. I gave the example also of artificial colors and flavors. This one young woman whose seizures went away when she avoided those artificial colors and flavors in her foods and just went to natural foods.
That is just fascinating. Dr. Adams, we're going to take one more quick break. And you're listening to Understanding Autism every second Monday and Tuesday from 3 to 4 here on Break Radio Show. And you can hear a replay of this on breakradioshow.com. Go to Archives Understanding Autism and hear yesterday's show as well as all the shows. But this is great information. We're here with Dr. Adams, and we'll be right back.
Buying or selling a home is one of the biggest events in your life. Wouldn't it be nice to have the guidance of a professional realtor that you can trust? I'm Tara Alves with HomeSmart, and I have been working with buyers and sellers in the Valley for well over a decade. As a native, I know the local market and I'm dedicated to meeting the needs of each and every client. I don't want to just list your home, I want to sell it and help you find a new place to call home. Call me for a free property valuation or for any real estate needs. Integrity, knowledge, professionalism, and results. That's what being a realtor means to me. Call today at 602-430-3397. That's 602-430-3397. Thank you.
It's always great to have a friend in business. That's why we encourage you to reach out to Brandon Ross at Burt Carpenter Financial, a full-service residential lender. Call now for exceptional service and an accurate pre-qualification. Connect with him online at BrandonRossHomeLoans.com or by phone at 602-953-7826, 602-953-7826. Brandon Ross, NMLS number 858655, and Burt Carpenter Financial, NMLS number 142159.
It's now time for the Word Association Game. Contestants, go ahead.
Bars. Meat market. Gas.
High prices.
Politicians.
Liars.
Auto mechanics.
Rip-off.
Guys! Whoa, 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 wait a minute here. Not when I think of my auto mechanic, I think of trust, care, safety, and fairness. This sounds like the definition of a friend, which was what Alexander's All Care Automotive Repair achieves with his customers. The peace of mind that comes with the mechanic that puts you first. Located at 3310 East Thomas Road, Phoenix, 85018. Call 602-956-3781. 602-956-3781. 3781.
Do you owe money to the IRS? Have you heard of possible payment options such as a partial payment installment agreement, offering compromise, or not currently collectible status? Knowing that you have options and what those options are will greatly relieve your worry and stress. Hi, my name is Dave Isaac, CPA and former government tax auditor. If you are curious as to what options may be available to you if you owe money to the IRS, my 25 years experience as a CPA may very well help you in these times of uncertainty. Stop worrying and start learning about what options you have. If you just want to talk to someone about your IRS debt or want specific advice, I invite you to call me at 602-625-3074. That is 602-625-3074. And when you call, ask for me, Dave Isaac, CPA and former government tax auditor.
And welcome back again. You're listening to Understanding Autism Live from the Regis Suites in Phoenix, Arizona. And Understanding Autism is on every second Monday and Tuesday of the month. We are here with Kim Isaac, Paul Loudon. I'm Dave Isaac, and very special guest, Dr. Jim Adams. And back to you, Kim.
Well, we're talking about seizures and autism. And Dr. Adams, what can you tell us about new and upcoming studies on seizures and autism?
Well, we are working on a treatment study right now. As I mentioned, there were three diets that our national survey found were most effective, the ketogenic diet and the modified Atkins diet we spoke about. There's a third diet that was also mentioned by families, and that's a gluten-free, casein-free diet. And if you think about it, when you go gluten-free, in other words, when you avoid wheat, that's a major carbohydrate. And also milk, when you go dairy-free and avoid milk, milk has a huge amount of milk sugar in it. And so those are both very carb-rich foods. And so a gluten-free, casein-free diet is also involves avoiding those. And so the national study I mentioned that we did found that that was also somewhat effective in reducing seizures, not as effective as the ketogenic, but it also yielded a lot of improvements in sleep, communication, behavior, attention, and mood. So very effective for those. So what we want to do in the study that we have just been approved to do is we want to combine a gluten-free, casein-free diet and the modified Atkins diet, and using a diet that's a combination of those two. Now, that's a pretty restrictive diet, but by doing that, we think that we'll be able to really reduce seizures in kids with autism and also, at the same time, improve all of their other symptoms. So that's our hope. So these diets have been used up till now mostly as a backup. So if someone doesn't respond to an anti-seizure medication, then they'll try a modified Atkins diet. But we think, actually, in many cases, you should consider it as a first line of treatment because it's going to improve all your other symptoms and not worsen them on average. And so we're going to be doing that study in two sites. We're working with two neurologists, one at University of Arkansas and one in New York City. And so families in those areas can apply, and we have openings for families to come and join those studies and try these special diets for 4 weeks. The great thing is that when you start these diets, usually you see benefits within a few weeks. And so you'll know within a few weeks if that diet is going to help you or not. And that's, you know, great in terms of families experimenting with different things. If it doesn't help you within a month, it's probably not going to help you. But if it does, sometimes it's huge. I mean, sometimes 90% reduction in seizures.
It appears, we talked about triggers and environmental factors, diets, medicine, medication, and that seems to worsen other symptoms, you said. Is there any other alternative ways to treat this that you know of? Or can you imagine maybe in the future with more research, could there possibly be other ways to treat this? Like some of the triggers we talked about, I guess avoiding the triggers certainly would help. And I did have another question, part two to this. Bright lights, does that trigger as well?
Not especially bright lights necessarily, but flickering lights. I'm forgetting the term for them. Strobe lights.
Strobe lights,
certainly induce seizures in individuals. And just that very rapid change can be very distressing to them. Some people will just give a headache to, but people with epilepsy can actually induce a seizure. So I think that some of the things we've seen for preventing seizures, certainly exercise seems to have a general calming effect. And I haven't seen very solid research on it, but certainly speaking with a number of individuals, they seem to feel that regular, steady exercise seems to help them feel calmer, seems to help reduce the risk of a seizure. Getting enough sleep, something as simple as that, because that sleep time is an important rest time and can help prevent it. And then also having a steady diet so that your blood sugar doesn't drop too low. There was one time when we were doing a blood draw on a child who was fasting in the morning, and the child had an absent seizure. And so we think that was due not to the blood draw, because it started before that, but it was just because they were fasting that morning. Curiously, though, on the other hand, there have been some studies that show that if you fast for a few days, that can actually be helpful in preventing seizures. Unfortunately, with young children who are growing, you don't want to try fasting. But for adults, that might be a reasonable thing, is to try fasting for a day or two, a short-term fast with the nutritionist or physician guiding you. And that might be a way to help get seizures under control. And finally, you asked about other researches. Pharmaceutical companies are putting a lot of effort into researching ways to alter neurotransmitter levels, especially ways to decrease glutamate or increase GABA, or with substitute chemicals, substitute neurotransmitters that have that sort of effect. You can do this by altering receptors. You can alter the levels of those. So a number of ways to approach it. So it's a very active area of research. But I always like going natural where possible.
I'm wondering how families can apply for the study. You said that you had some availability. How can families apply for that?
Oh, okay. So families can apply for a research study on a website, autism.asu.edu, and there's a simple application form there, and then depending on where they live, they can go to either of the two sites. Unfortunately, we're not recruiting families here in Arizona, but if families in Arizona are willing to make a few trips to one of those sites, then they could participate.
Okay. And also, we're coming to the end of the show, and I just wanted to announce to everybody reminders for this year's Autism Zoo Walk, October 4th. And the Zoo Walk raises money towards the research that Dr. Adams does with Arizona State University for these biomedical studies. Dr. Adams, do you want to tell us just a little bit about the Zoo Walk?
Sure. Zoo Walk is just a fun family event. You know, everyone of all ages, all abilities, likes going to the zoo and walking around. So it's a great family event. So the grandparents can be there with the kids, even with the babies, and the strollers walking around. You'll see thousands of other autism families there, probably recognize many friends or therapists there. And it's also a great fundraiser. As Kim said, it's a way to raise money for the research that we do, and that helps us do many of the studies that we've done so far. So a great family event. After the walk, families can stay the rest of the day at the zoo, and so they can explore it at their leisure. Lots of fascinating animals to see there, but also some great features there as well. And on a hot day, they have a water sprinkler, you can go ride the carnival, the carousel. Those are some great options.
Thank you so much. And if you want to join our team, we have a team, Paul and I. You can go to our Facebook page, www.facebook.com/understandingautismradio. We'll have all the information you need about this year's Zoo Walk. Dr. Adams, thank you so much again for coming on the show and sharing all of this information. I know it's very helpful for families.
Thank you all very much.
Okay, so we'll see everybody, I guess, next month. Stay tuned. Again, we'll post announcements on our Facebook about the Zoo Walk and upcoming shows.
Get out there October 4th, Zoo Walk, Phoenix Zoo. Have a good night.